So how is GPAS funded? These pie charts are several years old, 2017, but they're the most recent that SCDOT has on their website, so this is what we're using. It's showing on the left side the federal highway budget that comes to South Carolina. And you can see the National Highway Program is the big purple wedge, and the Surface Transportation Block Grant Program is the green wedge, and all those programs come to $917 million. When the SCDOT Commission approves how they break out that federal funding, there's a little bit more in there. I'm not sure where the discrepancy is in that, but it's just a hair over $1 billion. And then again, it's 2017 numbers, so they have changed. But the amount of funding that comes directly to GPAS is in this little blue wedge where the star is. Most of the other programs we've discussed, the pavement program is in the green wedge, bridges in the blue, interstate upgrades in the purple, and the others are all spread out throughout the pie. The little red wedge next to the MPO blue wedge, that's the funding that goes to the Council of Governments. So you can see how the funding is divided amongst the different programs from SCDOT down to the individual programs. When it comes to how we get our individual funding, it's a pretty complicated slide, so please bear with me, but it's proven to be effective in the past. Federal gas tax, state gas tax, and local funding. Those are our primary funding sources. Federal gas tax has remained 18.4 cents for gasoline and 24.3 cents for diesel for quite a long time. State gas tax, as we all know, has increased up to 26 cents per gallon for both gasoline and diesel. So right on that. That's the full implementation of the gas tax increase. And we have basically five programs that we fund with those. The Regional Mobility Program is the new name for the GuideShare program. We're probably still going to call it GuideShare because that's what everyone in the region has been used to. We've been calling that GuideShare since the 90s, I believe. And so we're probably still going to use both. GuideShare program to describe the funding, the regional mobility program will assume the program that guides GuideShare. So it'll be a little complicated at first. The non-GuideShare program, those are all the SCDOT projects that we help coordinate and cooperate with when SCDOT is managing them. FTA transit apportionments, those are the funds that go to GreenLink and CatBus, but after 2024, when the Transit 2024 funding comes in, it'll just be GreenLink. Transportation Alternatives Program, and then the MPO Planning Funds are called the PEO. So the funding amounts you can see here, right now our guide share is at $23.211 million per year. That is going to change. We're not quite sure how. DOT is still running the numbers from all the census changes. Since the allocation is based off population within the urbanized and MPO areas, and all those are changing, they're still running the numbers. So we're hopefully that, and we still have another 2 years worth of increases from SCDOT based upon that line chart of all those flowing DOT funding mechanisms that I showed earlier. So hopefully we're going to go up, hopefully close to 28 million, I think, is what we were expecting before the census changes, but we'll see how that all falls out, hopefully within the next few months. Yes, sir.
We may cover this in the next slide, but as we transition towards EVs, gas tax revenue goes down, then what?
We don't know. That's one of those things where we don't have any kind of projection on that, you know, until the state legislature takes action on what they want to do about electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. We have to assume, based off of our funding and how the federal government requires us to plan based off of our funding. Right now, we're showing $23.2 million per year for the foreseeable future. If something changes, then we change that. But because we don't have
kind of the crystal ball about what that's going to be. We can't change our expected funding until we have a better idea of what that's going to do. So we do know it's coming. We do know something has to change. We are hopefully not going to be too harmed or too stressed by that change. Before, I mean, there's going to be a transition period where the gas tax funding is going to decrease as more people transition to electric vehicles, but the funding mechanisms from electric vehicles haven't been fully implemented yet, or they're phased in, or they're insufficient, or we're not really sure yet. But during that transition period, hopefully things will still be okay. But we'll keep the policy committee and study team and everyone who was involved with GPATS as up to date as we can with how that's looking. As good as an answer as I can give it. The non-guide share, those are variable variable funds. They change from year to year. Most of those programs are prioritized statewide. So one year we might get hundreds of millions of dollars, like when we were doing the 85 interchange project. Some years it might be less. Right now, a lot of the interstate money is going towards Columbia. It's going to be going to Charleston. So the southern part of the state is going to get a lot more funding from the interstates, whereas we might get more safety funding or more grid replacement. So we keep a track of what the non-guide share funding is, but it's variable from year to year. FTA transit apportionments right now, it's just right at $7 million per year plus grants. I didn't include the grants we get in that number. The $7 million per year is current to fiscal year 2023. It will go down when we move to the Thompson area. But that money has been going up over the years.
Do you think GreenLink is going to fare off better now that Clemson is no longer going to be, they have done to share that part of funding?
Yes, when we talk about the transit funding specifically, we'll talk a little bit about how that split between GreenLink and CapBus works. And yes, GreenLink is going to probably be making it out a lot better than they currently are. Right now, the funding just in general is about two-thirds towards GreenLink and about one-third towards Clemson Area Transit. Mm-hmm. And while our overall allocation is going to go down, it'll be 100% GreenLink. So,
how do they account for the student population in this step? Because that's big at Clemson. I don't know how significant it is in an area now.
It's whatever is reported by the census. So we use the census populations because that's the most objective we can be. And so if those students, I can't remember if the students are counted in this.
So we use the census to bring the density to anyone else that are using it.
Right, the NTD data doesn't have population number.
So it's
whatever's reported by the census. If the students are reported in the census as population, so some of the more full-time students do report as full-time residents. Some of them don't. But if the students are not reporting as full-time students, they're not counting towards the population. So Clemson has a very efficient system, but it's also a much smaller system. So that's why they generally get smaller amounts. Transportation Alternatives Program is about $1.3 million per year. And then the MPO planning funds right now sits at about $900,000 per year from the feds. And then all those, federal gas tax is helping to pay for all these programs. State gas tax is helping to pay for the regional mobility program, non-guide share, DOT projects, and FTA apportionments. There's a state mass transit fund that they pay into. And then local funds, the matches come in from FTA, or for the FTA funds, Greenville County, the city of Greenville help pay for the GreenLink system. Applicants to the Transportation Alternatives Program help pay for that to match the $1.3 million for the TAP program. And then the MPO planning funds, the 20% of the fund, 20% match that is required from the locals, of that 20%, 75% is being paid for by Greenville County and 25% from Pickens County. So you could say 5% of the MPO planning funds are being paid for by Pickens County overall. I won't go through all this. This is what each of the programs pays for and what they do, but we've got slides on each of these. Regional mobility program, again, the guide share is paid for in the funding bills called the Surface Transportation Block Group Program. It's identified, planned, prioritized projects by GPS. And $23.211 million per year currently. That is 80% federal and 20% state funded by the gas taxes. That fund does not, it is not matched with any local funding, unless we add money to it, like it with the SC-183 project. Major GPAS projects, the 153 extension, which we'll go into in detail very quickly coming up. The Woodruff Road widening and parallel, also called the Woodruff Road Congestion Relief Project. The recently completed Batesville Road and SC-14 projects, et cetera. The biggest one under construction right now that everyone can see very easily is the projects that are currently being done on Roper Mountain Road and Roper Mountain Road Extension, and those are GPAS funded as well. We fund corridors, intersections, signal retiming, and as stated earlier, bike path transit, getting dedicated pots of funding coming up. Sangwa showed you the interactive map earlier. We're always going through that and helping to improve that, make it more useful, more clear. I think it's a cool picture, so don't compare that to what Sangwa showed earlier. Non-guide share projects, again, these are SCDOT, mostly built on statewide priorities. The amounts vary from year to year. Mostly interstates, bridge rehab and replacement, resurfacing, and safety projects. We also include other allocations like earmarks, state and federal programs like the recreational trails, Appalachian Regional Development Funds, et cetera. Congestion mitigation and air quality projects, we are not applicable right now because we are in air quality attainment. If we ever went into non-attainment, like Atlanta or Charlotte and many other metropolitan areas around the country, then we would qualify then for CMAQ funding, and that would be considered non-guide share. That would be a fund that we would then have to spend to try and improve our air quality. The downsides of receiving CMAQ funding are a lot worse. We don't want CMAQ funding. It's nice to have another pot of funding, but the downsides are a lot worse. So. And then whenever we get a grant, whenever that's awarded, that's also included in the non-guide share funding. And GPATS must still adopt those projects into the TIP, even though we don't have direct control over that funding, we have to be reflective of what's in the statewide transportation improvement program. So those still go into our financial statement. Again, this is a SCDOT slide. Number one fatality rate in the region, as we spoke about before, 80% of our pavements still need repairs. Secretary Hall has called this an $11 billion problem.
South Carolina has the number one.
We waver back and forth.
In the United States.
In the United States.
The
other side is a little bit old, but we waver in the top. Florida, us, Mississippi. Yeah. 750 structure deficient bridges. That number is going down with the new gas tax. I'm not sure what that number is at the moment. And then past the widening projects, which is where we're focusing in. So I'll turn it over to Osama to talk about transit.
Hey.
Yes.
Before Osama, can you talk to us about all of the other metros are getting funding, like we're getting funding. What accounts for the fatality rate? Do you know what?
What makes ours so much worse?
Yeah.
As Mayor Shoemaker.
But the Texan, but that's across the board. Is it because we're behind? Because other communities have sales tax and other funding streams to supplement what they're getting, and they can do better at maintaining the infrastructure?
It's all a part of that. It all comes together, whether it's the funding and the engineering that you can put towards the road, but funding and engineering only do so much. If driver behavior, that's out of our hands. Driver behavior is really out of our hands. We can put up as many signs, as many lights, as many roundabouts as we want. The pavement can be nice and smooth. Unfortunately, sometimes when you have nice, smooth, wide roads, people drive faster. And it's a whole lot easier to not pay attention.
So we don't know how to act in South Carolina, is what you
Well, and
is this news to you? Stop the presses.
Close the board.
It is a multifaceted problem, one that where Department of Public Safety and the Department of Motor Vehicles have to also play a role in the safety of the state. And so there's a lot of different. A lot of different avenues with this.
Pressure.
Yeah, we're
no. None of our big cars and trucks in this thing.
Yeah, a lot of trucks. Yes.
One thing that I think plays into it is the rural roads that we have, the windy, especially, and I don't know what the upstate looks like versus the low country, but I know if you're running in a rural area in the low part of the state, and you run out of the road, you're going to be in a car patch. In the upper part of the state, if you run out of the road, you're going to hit a tree or go down an embankment or something like that. So I think that plays a big picture in the conditions of roads. And it's not something we can fix overnight. Because if you think about I think about Pickens County and the rural roads over there, and the number of times that I see a cross, or a road painted right there in a hard curve, it's got trees and people run out of the road. So while our drivers may be a little more aggressive than they should be, I think, a lot of those, you're not going to fix that situation.
It is a very long-term situation. It is one of Chris Hall's priorities for the state, the rural road safety program. I mentioned earlier, the clear zones, as you mentioned, running off roads in your tree. If you're on a road, it's nice and straight or it's windy. Regardless, if you run off the road and you hit a tree, so you need that recovery space. So that you can either get back on the road or come to a safe stop. Additionally, a lot of our roads, when they were originally built, did not have that hold. So oftentimes you're running off the road and you're right into a ditch and then you can't recover.
Right.
So
it's
a lot of things. For the rural road safety program, a lot of it is having good paint so you can see the markings of the road at night, having that clear zone so that you're not immediately hitting a tree when you leave the road, having the paved shoulders, which it can be difficult because you have to move the ditches out, and sometimes that require buying property depending on where you are. So there's a lot of aspects to that, but yes.
Historically, and this is kind of an interesting thing to me, I remember in the legislature going back when I was in the House, the low country legislators passed legislation saying that they could not cut the trees in the middle of the interstate. On 26 going to Charleston, they wanted it to be aesthetically pleasing.
Right. Right.
If anybody's been to Charleston lately, they have taken all those trees out now. And that's because it became a safety hazard.
So. That's
really
it is a very long prospect, especially for the mine roads, the rural roads that have all the corrective attention need for resurfacing, sometimes full reconstruction, and then you've got to put additional paint shoulders on. So it's being worked on, but there's still a lot more to do.
Still say that, talking about, well, okay, if people run off the road, let's try and work on why people run off the road, which is don't mess with devices. Pay attention to what you're doing. Don't mess with devices, while you're driving. Don't be impaired while you're driving. So one thing that you personally can do for your safety on the road is that. Just, by golly, you got to be paying attention to all the people who aren't.
Yeah, I heard a joke in a session about a year ago about what's the best way to do that. And they said, outlaw automatic transmissions. Get everyone back on a manual transmission. You've got to be doing the shifting, and you've got to be working on the clutch things. You're not going to have the time or attention to be messing with the device. So, it was a joke. It doesn't bring with that same factor. With the automatic transmission, you're able to work on that mental space to be messing with your phone at the same time you're driving. Really,
the reality is that hands-free is not better.
It's, I mean, there's statistical studies that show that it's not better. And the best example I can give you is, can you watch a movie and talk to your mom on the phone and get both senses and eye?
No, I don't think anyone
you can. All.
Okay. This is a great conversation, great discussion. It really highlights a lot of the issues that she has. It really highlights a lot of the issues that we try to address at UCATS, and we do have the ability to do more with. We do have the ability to work more with the Department of Public Safety, Department of Motor Vehicles, through our partner, SCDOT and Federal Highways. So it's avenues we need to serve.
Just to add to some of the questions about safety and stuff, in our last LRTP, we did include some of those safety stuff. So, for example, specific types of roads that are most dangerous in the region. So, for example, White Wolf Road, Pleasant Burr, roads like that. 15% of the roads in the region, but they also account for roughly 65% of the incidents in the region as well, too. It was interesting what the senator said. Cut down the trees? What roads did they cut down? Was that the interstate, or did they do it like right before?
Yeah, 26, if you've got a Charleston, yeah.
Okay.
They have cleared a lot.
I do understand. All right, so this hasn't come out yet, but we worked on a little bit of and talked about things like aerosols and stuff like that. And from an engineering perspective, it is appropriate to cut down trees for energy because of how an interstate functions. The major issue we keep running into is roads like streets like White Horse Road, where you have high speeds, but you have people doing slow things like walking or turning properties and stuff. And those are why those streets are so particularly dangerous. Because you try to drive fast and someone's ready to stop, they can mess up one of the things really bad. But I can give you more of that kind of stuff to help you do some of the stuff that you're asking as well, too. All right, let's see. So, FTA funding. So these are the fundings that go specifically for transit in the region and of course around the country as well too. There are six that come from the Federal Transit Administration. We only deal with four. The other two are like guideway type projects like rail or busways that are strictly for transit. All right, so you ready to see this map? This is the Jim Patch region. This is the whole map. There we go. So we have the four types of funding that we typically get with in our region, right? So the first one, 5303. When it comes to our region, we just break it down in what terms PL funds in our region. That is allocated between the two transit providers. And then when it's not allocated, we sometimes withhold it to things like the LRTP project when that we end up doing that update every 5 or 10 years. 5307, that goes to the two transit providers and then usually help them fund their operational services like paying for their staff, for example, right? 5310, that is mostly managed by us. That is for people who are non-transit agencies, like transportation providers. Usually transportation providers are people who are providing people with transportation services for people who are elderly, disabled, or trying to get people to and from work. 5339, that is for capital projects. So for example, if you're trying to build a bus stop, for example, or put in a sidewalk to a bus stop so people can walk to the bus stop, for example. So that's how each one of those individual fundings work. Interestingly enough, like I know 5310 is made for transportation providers, people who are trying to help people who are elderly and disabled. One of the issues we've had over the years is that we can't get these people to apply for funding. And usually the reason is that they just don't qualify. For example, they might not get the local match, or they might not have the internal capacity to manage the funds after they get the money, so they don't apply for it. And that's our reason. We've had a couple of lapses over the years. So to prevent lapses, we have a policy where if there is funding that is about to lapse before lapsing, it automatically defaults to the transit providers because they have the wherewithal to go ahead and spend the money so that it does not lapse. Of course, you have money that comes from the federal government. So they get the 3% to 39, it goes strictly to transit agencies. Both those agencies are able to deal directly with the funding. The thing that we give them at our level is a split letter letting them know that how much they're going to give for that particular fiscal year. As Keith said earlier today, GTA gets about 2/3 of the funding, and Catalyst gets about 1/3, and it slightly fluctuates from that number from year to year. And this is basically shows that allocation. This is what happened back in 2021. We are now in 2023, so it's far different numbers, most likely different numbers than that 2021 number that you see up there. This is a spreadsheet. Basically, we keep track of what we do throughout the years. Updates this slide, but we have money going in the 2022 and 23 as well too. It shows you how much of each money buys through the year. So, for example, 5307, you see that we get roughly $3.5 million from that. 5310, that's been going up through the last couple of years. What used to be roughly 350K has now gone over 400K. 5339, roughly 350, and that's going down, interestingly enough. And then SMTL, that one is specifically from the state as opposed to the federal government. And what we allocated with the formula funding, just like what was the company the federal government. And then, as you see, green link, Clemson below, how we allocate each particular funding, depending on how much they're getting allocated for that fiscal year. All right, let's see. 5310, the one that we specifically manage. All right, so for the most part, like I said earlier, it's also for people who are elderly or disabled. All right, so things that you can spend the money on. So there's two types of expenses. There's capital expenses, and then there's operational expenses. Capital is like physical infrastructure, like vans, the lifts, the technology. Tools, maintenance equipment, things of that nature. Here's a couple other examples of that as well, too. And the first thing we do is particular funding project. 55% of all funding for the B10 must be dedicated to capital expenditures. If you don't have 55%, we can't, but we got to find a way to get your 55%. And then, of course, other things that are non-traditional expenses, like, for example, we talked about the idea that if these funds are going to apply for, it defaults to transit providers. So, for example, they might use for something like building a bus stop or a sidewalk for a bus stop if they get the funding instead.
So that's not for operational, it's mainly just for capital expenditures?
Correct. A certain percentage you can use for operational, 49%. Right, so, for example, when you get the transportation providers, if you want to pay the bus, the driver of the bus, those services, that would be an operational expense at that point.
Things like insurance. Yeah. Because if you have, because I had disabled parents who were living with me, they could bring a bus, could come to the house and pick them up and take them to their appointments and anything like that. So, they can't provide those similar services that nonprofits typically do. Yeah. I was just hoping it's just not all capital, because I'm sure there's a lot of operational with that.
Yeah, think of it like, so for example, when it comes to the transit providers, when it comes to their ADA services, they only provide services to people who live within 3/4 of fixed crowd. So you can get to the bus stop or use the bus, then if you live within that footprint, they'll come and transport you within that footprint.
So you have to be near a bus stop that they are route they already have.
Correct, right. Near. And then if someone is willing to provide services outside of the current transit footprint, that's when they apply for these types of funds. That's how that works. Let's see. And of course, when it comes to capital expenditures, the federal government funds that at 80%. When it comes to operations, so they're going to fund that at 50%. And this is not the chart. Basically, how we keep track of money through the years. This one was updated. So, roughly, we got about $358,000 available for potential transportation providers, right? People can provide these types of flexible services, right? But the way we have it right now is a policy, especially to prevent lapses. We right now allocate 2/3 of all 5310 funding to both transit agencies, and some allocated using the formula funding that I talked about earlier today, right? right? And if, whatever situation, like there's no need to apply for the leftover funding, you know, the $358K, then that amount also defaults to the club.
So they get all the money essentially.
Potentially, yeah. Defaults to the two transit providers and really get catapults. Because the purpose, like, from my perspective, is to prevent lapses. It's happened two times since we started the program. And it was a big point of attention last year. So as a policy fix, basically all money that is not applied for within that fiscal year automatically defaults to the transit agencies to spend down. And it's very possible that the transit agencies might not have a local match to spend it. And that money does pass, but we don't think it's going to happen. As far as I can tell, it's not. So, any other questions?
So, I'm going to present on the Transportation Alternatives Program, also known as TA Program or TAP. It's a competitive grant program that was created strictly for non-motorized transportation options. Because GPAS is a TMA, like I mentioned earlier, we manage our own TAP program and our own application. We do a call for projects at the beginning of each year, and the TAP applications are ranked by the GPAS policy. Very last year, SCDOT released new TAP guidelines based on the guidance they got from the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. This new program prioritizes safety. They want to see that this project doesn't contribute to any serious injuries or fatalities for people that are going to be walking and biking. They also want to see a lot of public involvement. They want to see that the applicant has engaged with the community members so that the project is supported in the community. And then also would like to see more projects located in high need areas. An example of that could be a trail that gets people to employment opportunities or education opportunities. If we worked with them to get all three of these components into our program as well. So eligible TAP activities, they all have to have a transportation component. Any recreational trails would not be eligible. So pedestrian bicycle facilities, safer school projects, or complete streets are eligible for TAP money.
Specifically, you can't do anything when you're doing complete streets. Nothing that relates to vehicular movement would be eligible. We had a project long ago in the city of Greer, where they were replacing their masters in downtown, and they were using TAP monies for the pedestrian units on those masters for people to walk across crosswalks. And their original application had the masters for the traffic lights in there, and DOT turned them down. And they said, you can buy the pedestrian heads, but you can't buy the masters. So they're very strict about what can and cannot be spent.
E-bikes with this.
We have not seen an application for that. I don't even know if that's eligible. Mostly we're staying out of that.
I don't think that's ever. Here are the eligible applicants for TAP projects. We mostly have had cities, counties, and school districts that applied. Jobs Act, which I mentioned earlier, is a TAP program through 2026. We receive an allocation of around $1.3 million. And we find out what that is at the beginning of each year when we do our call for projects. That funds up to 80% of a project's total cost with a 20% minimum local match. There's a big emphasis on minimum because that oftentimes becomes more than 20%. And then this is a new point that SBT just changed. Applicants that applied to GPAS to have funding and were denied are now allowed to apply to SCDOT's TAP program. So if we got several different applications and we couldn't fund them all, if we had to deny some, those applicants could then apply to SCDOT's program, but they would have to go through GPAS first. Texas, the GFAS TAP cycle in January. We get our application and we do our call for projects in March. In mid-March, the application will do, and then we have these applications in April. We have the application review by the GFAS bicycle and pedestrian coordinating committee and the study team. And then study team gives their recommendation in April, which is then passed along to the policy committee in May. And then winning projects are moved into the GFAS TIP. This is our most recently awarded project. This was awarded back in May at the policy committee. City of Greer applied for several $1 million for a trail along Lawrence Creek. This is a recently completed project. City of Greenville applied for $400,000 in 2016 for sidewalks along Taylor Road. Another example, in 2015, Town of Williamston applied for $200,000 for the minor street sidewalk project. That is what we have on the tab.
We'll say that we have measures in place to make sure that no technology lapses, just as we can say for transit, we can use tap money in guideshare projects. So when we are programming GPAS projects, if there's a phase of work that would include bicycle or pedestrian amenities on a road, roadway or corridor or at an intersection, if we do have an excess of tap funding that hasn't been applied for, we can transfer that money over from the TAP program into the guideshare program. Okay, so, and finally, the PL program, the Unified Planning Program. With the local matches for the fiscal year 2025, it's going to be just over $1 million. So that's 80% federal and 20% local. Again, with that local, 75% Greenville County, 25% Pickens County, $80,000 is provided to each GTA and campus federal development grant money. That's the FDA section 53 of me that was talked about. And then they provide actually that $80,000. So that's $20,000 from each of them. And that helps with their transit money. PL funds provide to the 4 GPATS operations, staff, skill, police officers, training, and travel. If one funds all of our plans and activities, any kind of data, we have to acquire any printing of plans, the maintenance of the GPATS website, et cetera, et cetera. But there, we also have, it has to be within federal allowances. And some of those restrictions are fairly common. They're fairly comprehensive. So we're well restricted in what we can spend, and we do the best we can. But being a small and efficient staff of just 4 dedicated employees, we do have carryovers in our PL fund, and that's what we make available. It's over, I say over $100,000 annually. The last few years, it's been a good deal more. I think last year it was $500,000. It's banked by GPATS in anticipation of major needs like our 10-year LRPP that usually costs several $100,000 just in itself. When we get travel model updates, expensive studies, surveys by consultants. But then whatever we can provide, we do culture project for those special studies that Anna website we talked about earlier that we've done for our jurisdictions. It's for planning and analysis only. We can't do any kind of actual engineering or ratify acquisition or construction. So no project implementation, but it does require the local match by the applying jurisdiction. But it really does help to provide a lot of great funding for our local jurisdictions who otherwise would not have money to do these good transportation plans. But new requirements for those who have applied or in the past are considering to apply for special studies. SCUT is now requiring a local public administration from the planning level, which
those criteria are still being drafted on bicycle teams. And that certification is going to be required from here on out to accept GPAT's funding for these studies. Staff is going to be providing more details next year when we do the call for projects. Local public administration is basically SDOT's method of certifying governmental agencies or nonprofits or any type of agency that wishes to spend federal or SDOT money on the networks that they maintain. So it's basically their certification process. And again, that's just a shout out to the page that Dennis showed you earlier, all the studies that we've done. And there are links, if you go to that page, all of those are links to the actual studies themselves. And we do have the link back even further. We're always trying to follow those older studies that we've done. I think they go back to 2006. Let's look at that. Okay. As mentioned, the House Committee is 30 members, currently 7 non-voting members. The size is not regulated. It has to be representative of the region. So you have to be having members that are representing all of the area for which we are responsible for. Currently have 8 legislative delegates, 5 from Greenville, 2 from Pickens, and 1 from Anderson. 8 county councilors, 5 from Greenville, Pickens, 1 from Anderson. Currently, 11 municipal mayors, 6 from 6 mayors of Greenville, 4 from Pickens, and 1 from Anderson. But again, because we're removing the mayor of Clemson and the mayor of West Pelzer, due to the census reorganization, that'll be going down by 2 to 9 municipal mayors. We also have the SADOT commissioners from our region. We've got one that covers both Greenville and Spartanburg, and the other that covers Pickens and Anderson, and I believe I saw Commissioner Christopher on, so she's actually here today. And also the chair of the Green Transit Authority. The chairs of the transit agencies in the region are required to be voting members by federal regulation. We only have the GTA chair because the county does not have a board. The mayor of Clemson was serving as that on that role, so it's kind of serving a dual purpose for that transit agency. Policy committee is responsible for carrying out provisions of legislative requirements, provides policy progression, planning, programming, and implementation, makes funding rules or rejects projects and plans or GPATs, and then makes recommendations to councils, delegations, state and federal departments, and other bodies. Also does letters of support for other jurisdictions. Applications. And that sort of thing. Policy committee typically meets 4 times a year. Sometimes call additional meetings, but typically 4 times. The proposed times to be voted on in October for 2024 will be February 26th, May 13th, August 19th, August 21st. And we mail agendas out a week in advance. If anyone wants to get those agendas, we do mail them out to the informational attendees as well. You just have to let us know. You know, one of us gets from our informational attendees list. Formal document changes, like for the longer transportation plan, transportation program, program, and all the other requirements, things like that, require a 21-day advertising period. And these are officers, Senator Chris Rice. The chair, vice chairman, and Senator Ross Kerr from Greenville. It's a 2-year term of office. Our next election will be coming up in February. And then the secretary and executive director is myself through designation from Fremont County. No, it wasn't that.
Quorum
is a majority of voting members, currently 15. If all committee goes in the new bylaws, these are voting members, come down to 14 at the next meeting. And again, as Dana showed, the list of the policy committee is on our website, including links to bylaws and previous agendas and meeting minutes. So 19, as mentioned, 470 members, keep that staff and maybe transport. Is the jurisdictional membership representative of the area, district planners, engineers, public works staff, financial folks. It's a technical committee responsible for supporting and implementing policy decisions that provides updates, feedback, and implementation. There's technical issues ahead of the issuance of the agenda so that we can make sure that we're presenting the policy committee with the best information. And we issue formal recommendations with final votes to the policy committee and agenda items for consideration. So we usually will just ask if there's any objection to presenting an item to the policy. We're open-ended meetings with any transportation planning professionals welcome to attend and participate in all of our meetings are open to the public that's interested. And members can be extended at any time to the professionals. As mentioned, we don't do formal vote for you. There's a recommendation by consensus. The study team please don't vote. It's either unanimous support, consensus with objection, usually formal objection to the policy committee. No consensus if there's a significant objection that results in a split recommendation. Or no recommendation at all, but there's issues with the agenda might have resulted in a lack of recommendation with the policy committee. So he was well meets four times per year. I won't read out the dates, but it's typically 3 to 4 weeks ahead of policy committee meetings. So that we can, after the study team meeting, issue that 21-day public advertising for any items that needed. Staff engagement, Greenwood County is contracted to staff GPATS under the authority of the county administrator, and then goes to T. Coker, the deputy administrator for committee planning and development, to Rashida Jeffers Campbell, who is the director of planning and zoning, and then to designated to myself as the transportation planning manager and our staff. We do get additional support services from Greenville County as needed. Financial and procurement structure, Greenville County holds all of our PO funds, receives all, it distributes the funding for all the GPATS activities. We have limited legal counsel on very limited legal counsel because the county attorney's office is not contracted to do GPAS legal counsel. It does provide some feedback and some value on some specific occasions. As say we're saying in Greenwood County, so if the county does facilitate meetings, meeting spaces and equipment with all of our computers, county computers. And then additional staff support. Sometimes in meetings we need more than just the forms. Sometimes the county can supply some long range planners to help out. GPATS bylaws, what they accomplish is they establish the purpose and by the authorizations that I presented earlier. It establishes the policy committee and study team makeup and establishes the officers' terms and elections that went through just now. The meetings, how often meetings are, the forums, the meetings, method, and the public transparency methods. And staff, and also has some amendments that also allows for redesignation. That the point for redesignation was put in when we expanded in after the 2010 census in case Clemson was able to break up the MPU. So we do allow for the idea that there might be an area with the chance, but qualifies that they can't actually work in that wasn't able to be so on their own before. There's regional coordination study team subcommittees. We've got a transit a coordinating committee that assault runs and a vice ministerial coordinating committee that Indiana heads up. We do coordinate with federal highways, federal transit, SPT, and other avenues of the from the state and the country. Fairly quickly, our primary coordination is with FATS, parents and campus council governments and CDOT districts two and three, and also participate in statewide initiatives. I mentioned earlier, they're focused on the more super regional. Thanks for that.
Thank you so much.
And the national level, we participate at the Association of Metropolitan Planning Organizations conferences every few years. But it depends on where they are and what they're going to be covering. And then federal initiatives, we did participate in the Federal Realty Administration Southeast Region Realty, which is the that is planning for the Southeast High Speed Rail between Atlanta and Charlotte. So we're hopeful that that can keep moving forward at some point, but it's still very major. Okay, I know we are half an hour on schedule. I may have any other points. I will leave it up to the discretion of or to the decision of the group. I'll see if we can take the example. You're welcome to get that. Yes, ma'am. Unless there is any objection to skipping it, we can move right into a little bit of question and answer and discussion. This was provided in 2021, and it will be included on the slides that we put on the website. For the sake of time, and again, my apologies for this, wrong. There's a lot of good discussion.
No objections.
Okay, no objections on Zoom. Any objections in here? Yeah. It's basically looking through the process that we go through on each individual project and why we would see expanded time frames on projects and why we would see cost increases on some, especially when there's a lot of issues in the projects. So it is perfect out, it is at least probably half hour presentation. So we'll make sure that next time we do this training, we're going to extend the time and maybe the points but hearing open it up in case anyone still here on Zoom in the room has any question and answers that have been discussed during the training. Anyone on Zoom? All right. Appreciate your attendance and appreciate you hanging with us. Thank you very much for your attendance.
Have any questions or any feedback? Please email us and us. Okay. If any questions or questions, we'll have this adjourned. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
And so as an example, and again, I'm going to try and keep this as brief as possible. SC-153 extension in Easley, recently completed project. we had an initial scope that it was going to be about 2.7 miles long. It was going to be in two phases originally, a two-lane section, center turn lane, where appropriate, and a multi-use path. The final project ended up with three new roundabout intersections. And the purpose was to continue SC-153 from US 123 to Saluda Dam Road and Olive Street. The map on this slide is rotated 90 degrees, so I could fit it in. My apologies. When we put it into the long range transportation plan, whenever we're putting a project into the long range transportation plan, it has to meet goals, objectives, and priorities to improve safety, reduce congestion, and it must be multimodal. that those the multimodal requirement is a more recent requirement, but is one of the reasons why we are including bicycle and pedestrian, not only with every project that we do, but we're also considering standalone multimodal projects. It has to have significant public engagement. The project has to be vetted, and not just in the LRTP, but once the project is moving forward, there is a lot of public engagement on not only from GPATS, but also SCDOT. The project scope needs to be identified. We need to do travel model runs, which right now Appalachian Council of Government is running our travel model. We get external data from SCDOT, South Carolina Department of Public Safety, and South Carolina Department of Natural Resources to identify any kind of environmental constraint. The projects are ranked per SE Act 114 and the performance measures to get that objective criteria, which SCDOT then verifies. For the SC-153 extension, we identified this project in 2005, in the 2005 to 2007 Long Range Transportation Plan. The public engagement for that plan was held in 2006 and 2007. The conditions on US 123 necessitated the project, as the SC-153 extension or SC-153 interchange with 123 always assumed eventual continuance. Anyone who was on 153 and pulling off onto 123 saw that there was a berm that they had put when they installed that interchange that would allow for the continuance of the road. The growth had easily continued to accelerate in the 90s and early 2000s, and the project had been considered for a large amount of time. We hadn't been able to work out a scope of a project that was acceptable to Pickens County and the city of Easley. And so we were able to get a scope that with this LRTP that was acceptable. And so we identified two phases. The first phase was going to go from 123 up to Prince Perry Road, and now it's going to be primarily utilizing existing road infrastructure and putting in some new bridges to get over the Norfolk Southern Railroad. And the second phase was going to extend from Prince Perry Road up to Saluda Dam Olive. That was going to be mostly new location, and there was some wetlands impact. You can see where the blue line stream crosses underneath. So we had some issues with that, which I'll get to in a moment. The SC-153 ranking, you can see the congestion scores and the VC ratio, that's vehicle to capacity. That's the measure that we currently use for evaluating congestion. How many vehicles are on the road versus what that road can handle. And so that's our measure of congestion. So because most of the project was new location, there was actually a positive net gain in vehicle to capacity. So it actually worsened the capacity, but because the road that was not in existence beforehand, it was actually looking at a measure of what the new road could take on and take off of US 123. Because the road was not in existence, it didn't have a significant safety score, but it did provide what sections were in existence and did improve multimodal safety. So it did score a few points that way. This was the scoring metric from that long range transportation plan. It's drastically changed, which I'll talk about in a moment. But you can see all the criteria data for both phases that we went through. And this was the process that was required at the beginning of South Carolina Act 114 in 2007 when we were wrapping up the long range transportation plan. This chart is from that long range transportation plan. These are all the projects that were ranked at the top of the list. There's another whole other page of lower ranked projects below this. You can see highlighted in green and orange the phases of the 153 extension, and you can see that they're ranked low, and there is a reason for that, why we did them when they were ranked low, and I'll get to that in a moment. So they were in the 2007 long range transportation plan as part of the 14 fiscally financially constrained projects out of 94 vision projects and completely separated from the 100 plus intersection projects in that plan. Bicycle and pedestrian improvements were to be funded with the above projects. At that time, we didn't have any standalone funding for bike ped, and we didn't rank transit and signals along with those projects. And as you saw in the previous slide, the SC-153 extension phase one ranked number 30, even though it needed to happen first. And phase two, the effectiveness actually ranked it a little bit higher at number 27. Once a project is in the long-range transportation plan, it sits and waits for its turn based on its ranking. It can be re-ranked with future LRTPs if the conditions of the road worsen. So it's never a bad thing to get a low-ranked project on the LRTP. I know we're reaching our 5-minute warning for 11 a.m. And I know that some people probably have other meetings after this. If you need to leave, please feel free. And we can follow up on this as you need afterwards if you must leave right at 11. But we're going to press on, and I'm going to move through this and get to any final questions and answers and discussion as needed. But I think we do have, I do want to make sure that we get out as quickly as possible. So a project in the long-range transportation plan, we do hope that we can move them into the transportation improvement program. It all depends on how much money is available for projects. We bring those projects into the long-range transportation plan in ranking order per Act 114, unless there is a significant reason. Once we did the 2007 long-range transportation plan, which was adopted at the, I think it was November of 2007. It's a little while ago. In 2008, we did a transportation improvement program amendment to bring the top ranked projects into the TIP to get them funded. So all prior projects in that 2008 transportation improvement program have been cleared off. We were starting from scratch in 2008. We're actually still paying that off. At the top of our financial statement, you can see debt service. We're actually paying that through 2023, I think, is the final year that we're paying that off. So in 2007, we provided a whole new list of projects. The projects in green, are projects that are now completed. We've brought in other projects since, of course, with every TIP, with every new TIP, we bring in new projects, but we're down to two projects, and that's the Jamison intersection and the Batesville road widening. Jamison is currently on hold pending the State Infrastructure Bank decision on SC-183, and Batesville road is actually under construction right now. And so we're moving forward, but you see SC-153 is on there as being completed. So SC-153 was chosen for the TIP, even though it was low ranked, due to its regional priority, prior work being done, and the relative newness of SC Act 114. The objective criteria has been greatly refined since. We know that in our current LRTP and TIP process, that projects like SC-153 would have ranked a lot higher, primarily because we didn't account for the SC-123 impacts on 153 when we were doing the ranking. And so that's one of the reasons why the Woodruff Road Parallel ranked so high is, had we done the Woodruff Road Parallel ranking the way we did 153, the Woodruff Road Parallel would not have been ranked as high. But when we did the Woodruff Road Parallel, we took into consideration the impacts to Woodruff Road itself, which is what ranked it up. And so that's why we knew that, which is why 153 was chosen to be funded, even though it was low ranked. The original program was only phase one at the time. It was going to be $10.5 million. You can see the breakout there. And when we brought into the TIP, it had a delay of 2 years based on the higher priority projects before we could get started with PE. So we were planning on starting PE in 2010. And it did start, but it took a lot longer to do the NEPA document, the National Environmental Policy Act, which defined the accurate scope, costs, and alternatives. I think we did get a finding of no significant impact, or those impacts were noted. I don't think we needed to do an EIS on this project, but that got us to 60% plans. But due to the complexity of the project, as defined by NEPA, and NEPA doing its due diligence, SCDOT doing the due diligence during the NEPA phase, in 2011, we brought tip changes to increase the cost, specifically of the PE to $2.2 million, and extended the PE phase out to 2012, pushing back right-of-way acquisition and construction. And so construction would not begin until 2014. So that would be about a two-year delay of the project. By June of 2013, the new tip from 2014 to 2019, SCDOT requested to bring phase two into the project, and to do it near the same time. This doing both phases delayed the project construction to 2016. And you can see the project increases in cost there. By January 2015, prior to beginning right-of-way acquisition, the wetlands mitigations credits ran out. And Mr. Carvin shaking his head on the video. He's very familiar with what happened then. The project was, for lack of a better term, halted. SCDOT was still able to finish up the right-of-way acquisition, but all other work on the project needed to halt while the wetlands mitigations credits issue was resolved. That didn't get the Corps of Engineers permit signature until July of 2017. So it resulted in a 2.5-year delay to the project. I won't go into the wetlands mitigations credits issue in detail right now. We just don't have the time. But again, they were able to finish the right-of-way acquisition in 2017 and were able to open bids for construction in November of 2017 with Thrift Development as being the low bidder. Construction began in April of 2018 and expected completion by August of 2020, which is 6 to 7 years later than the initial estimates when we first programmed the project into the TIP. The substantive construction was completed on time and under budget. I think the ribbon cutting was held in November, if I'm remembering correctly. I've got pictures, but it was under budget. I'll have that. Those amounts in a slide in a moment, but here's the final product of the 153 extension. End of the ribbon cutting. The original program, which again was the first phase, was a 3 to 4 year project that was going to cost $10.5 million. The final program, which was both phases, so keep in mind this, both phases basically doubled the size of the project, was a 10-year project that cost $25.878 million. We had originally budgeted 24, well, not originally, by the end of the environmental permitting, the wetlands mitigation process, we had budgeted $24 million for construction, and Thrift Development came in with $19.3 million. So it actually the construction came in under budget, which was a nice feather for SCDOT to have, I'm sure. But throughout this whole process, and this is not an atypical project, public construction projects will always take longer and be more expensive than originally planned. This is typical. We see this with every single project we do. But local support will yield a better project, better product. And that's one of the purposes of GPATS, is to get that local support. If not financially, then at least from a jurisdictional concurrence that a project needed to be done, and assistance with making sure that we, you know, keep that back and forth between Federal Highways, SCDOT, and the local jurisdictions. That's one of the primary purposes of GPATS. SCDOT is changing the process. I know Casey Lucas and Betsy McCall from DOT, we've talked a lot, and Betsy McCall has made presentations to GPATS about the changing process. We are, as I mentioned, we're adding in the PL the PL planning phase of work prior to PE, and I talked about that a little bit earlier. That will help us get an idea of the cost and scope before we fully commit to a project, and so we don't have these additional overruns, or at least not as bad as we did with this project and with a lot of our others. We will not be planning PE right-of-way construction, so we're not going to come to GPath and say this project is going to cost $10 million and then end up costing $25 million. We'll get an accurate picture of that cost prior to programming the funds in the TIP. And again, this can result in the project being scrapped completely if the policy committee says, no, we don't want to move forward with that project. It's too expensive. Because if we move forward with a project beyond the PL phase, once federal funding is spent, the project must be completed or those federal monies must be repaid. As an example, the Woodruff Road Parallel did not have a planning phase. It occurred before the feasibility reports were implemented by SCDOT. Many of you are familiar, if you've been with GPATS for any length of time, you're familiar with this project. We've accelerated it as much as possible. But the initial cost when we first programmed it into the Long Range Transportation Plan was $30 million. When we brought it into the TIP, it was $42 million. And then the NEPA document, which was just signed, said it was $121 million. Since we've already spent several million dollars on engineering and it is definitely a project that needs to be done, we are fairly committed to this project. The State Infrastructure Bank has agreed to fund a majority of that remain. The difference between the 42 and 121 will be funded by the State Infrastructure Bank with Greenville County match. And so we are moving forward with this project, even with the significant cost increases. It won't cost any, unless there's any overruns in the project, which is what we see anyways, we're currently sticking to the $42 million for GPAT's cost. I wanted to mention that because one of our highest ranked projects is Garlington Road. It was in the 2040 Long Range Transportation Plan, Garlington Road, from Woodruff Road to Roper Mountain Road was our top ranked project. We brought it in to the TIP with a previous TIP, and because the feasibility reports had started, we only programmed that PL phase, only $300,000, which is what SEDOT said preliminary. We can refine that once we get closer to the start of that feasibility report, but the placeholder was for $300,000 for the feasibility report. As you can see, we've got to be determined in the remainder for that project. I actually cut so I could make the screen large a little bit larger. I cut off a little bit of the TIP. But we're not planning the PE, the right-of-way acquisition, or the construction for that project yet. And you can see that's the same with every project below it that's been brought in since. And one of the reasons we're doing this is because we've identified that plan cost for phase one as $8.55 million, and we don't know whether that's accurate or not without getting into the PE and the engineers actually taking a look at that project. And phase one is only, even phase one, which was ranked number one in our last longer transportation plan, only goes up to Roper Mountain Road. But we have identified phase two. It ranked number 48. But as we've seen with 153 extension and with last year's example, I use Salters Road, which was recently completed, it is usually much more effective and efficient, cost efficient, to be doing both phases at once. And so the purpose and need of the project can be better met by doing both phases at once. And as we've seen with some of the developments that have been happening especially in I think it's the Hartness property, is there's a lot of development that's happening on Garlington Road. And so the situation has changed. And while we will be reevaluating Garlington Road phase two, we're accepting the fact that we may have to be doing both of these phases at once. And the feasibility report that we funded for Garlington Road phase one will figure out whether we need to do both of those phases without having to fully fund phase one. And we're getting in too deep and we're spending money on preliminary engineering and right-of-way acquisition, and oh, now we need to do phase two, and the cost explodes. And so that is all I have on that, is just kind of how we're evolving our process and how the process has, how GPATS fits into the process. As the study team and the policy committee will be making the recommendations and the decisions on each step of this process, and as staff and the DOT that are on the call, we'll make sure that you have the information that you need to make whatever decisions that you need to. And so right now, I've been noticing that there's been a chat. I haven't been able to get to it. My apologies. Councilman Saito, we will be, I'll get that information to you for the traffic fatalities. I'll get Brennan Asangwa to pull that together and we'll get that for you. Are there any questions or brief discussion? I know we're about 10 minutes over. That's not as bad as I feared it could be. But I will be happy to take any brief question and answers and discussions at this time.
Keith, this is Butch. Just let me say, on behalf of Senator Rice and myself and the GPATS Policy Committee, we appreciate everyone's time and attention to this important presentation this morning. And we appreciate you and your staff for the great job you did on making these presentations. Complex subject, very concise time constraints today. So there's a lot more to do and to learn. And like you said, don't hesitate to contact you or your staff or me or Senator Rice or anybody that can help you with answering any questions you may have. And I just wanted to say that before I turn it back over to you to entertain any questions that anyone on this call may have today. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kervin. And thank you to all the policy committee members who have served or are serving now. And if you're brand new, thank you for being willing to serve on GPATS. Your participation is what makes this work. And this goes to the study team as well, who participates from the region from a staff perspective and providing your technical expertise. Without the participation of the policy committee and the study team, we'd have a much more difficult time of remaining in compliance with federal regulations when it comes to this. All of this is brought down by federal highways to ensure that the local jurisdictions are included in the transportation decision-making process, which is absolutely critical. And so your participation is greatly appreciated every step of the way. All right, any questions or discussion that anyone on the call may have?
Keith, this is Rex. Just, I want to say again, echo, thank you for what you did, and this is a great presentation.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
Yeah, great work, Keith. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Okay. hearing no other questions, I'm going to wrap up. Again, this presentation is being recorded. The audio portion of it, the video would be way too large to be housing on a website, but we'll provide the audio portion and all the slides on gpats.org in the GPATS 101 page as soon as we can get that uploaded. And so I think hearing none, I hope that we can see most of you at the GPATS Policy Committee meeting on Monday at 10 a.m. Remember, if you were sent out the Zoom invite, please remember to register for that in advance. So unless anyone has anything else, and we'll hold this training adjourned. Thank you very much for your attendance today.
Thanks, Rob.
All right. Thank you.